So, I hope you all found the cherries on the back table. They're beautiful to look at and good to eat. I was on a meditation retreat a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that came up for me on the retreat is the memory of my first meditation retreats many years ago. And it was kind of a painful memory. I had a lot of dukkha in my first meditation retreats. Meditation wasn't easy when I started out for me. And I had these ideas about what I was supposed to be getting out of this experience, and my ideas didn't match the reality. It wasn't happening. I thought I was supposed to be all tranquil and calm, and instead I had monkey mind, and it only got worse with 6 or 8 sittings a day. And I heard a teacher at a retreat tell a story about that contradicted my story, or was kind of the opposite of my experience. This teacher was describing the experience of his wife, who was not a practitioner. She was not a Buddhist, and she was not a meditation practitioner. But her husband was an up-and-coming teacher, so she wanted to do a retreat, and she went off and sat a 10-day retreat and came back and reported to her husband, the teacher, what her experience was. And he was flabbergasted, because he said, that's the report, that's the experience of someone with quite a lot of experience. And he said, how did you do that? And his wife said, I just listened to the instructions. So that's what I wasn't doing in my early retreats very well. I think I was hearing the instructions, but it was overlaid with this idea that I had in my mind of what I wanted to be happening, or what I thought was supposed to be happening. So it took me quite a while to get out of the way. And now I just love instructions. Howie's instructions are particularly good. I never get tired of being reminded of the basics. The instructions are generally pretty simple, like the instruction I read from Ajahn Amaro at the beginning of the sit. Here's one from the Buddha. The Buddha suggested that we develop a mind that is vast like water, where experiences, both pleasant and unpleasant, can appear and disappear without conflict, struggle, or harm. Rest in a mind like water. Both Ajahn Amaro's instruction and the Buddha's instruction emphasize the word rest. So I take this to be a reference to right effort. Right effort is the sixth factor on the Eightfold Path. It comes just before concentration and mindfulness. So right effort usually applies to our practice of meditation. And the lesson that it took me a while to learn when I was younger and newer at this was that right effort doesn't mean striving. Most of us, like me, were raised in this culture of acquisition and accomplishment. We're used to getting things and achieving things and being productive. We think about getting something out of our education, our livelihood, or even our hobbies. We have bucket lists. So it's not surprising that we apply these cultural values very often to our spirituality. We think we're here to get something. Maybe it's peace of mind, freedom from suffering, or some new understanding about ourselves. But the instructions and the teachings on right effort suggest we do the opposite very often. So this is another example where Buddha Dharma is going against the stream. It's certainly going against the stream of our culture, our habits of mind. So it takes a little practice. Zen master Dogen says, "You should cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself." I really love that quote because of the backward step. I like the idea of meditation practice and Dharma practice being a backward step rather than a step forwards to getting something or acquiring something. We're letting go of something instead. One particular definition of mindfulness that I particularly like is, quote, "an open and receptive, non-judgmental awareness of your present moment experience." As simple as that. Mindfulness is an open and receptive, non-judgmental awareness of your present moment experience. Both the words receptive and non-judgmental suggest not doing rather than doing. So the teaching sometimes suggests that right effort is more about letting go than striving. And for me, this is an aspect of the third noble truth, freedom from suffering, is letting go. It's skillful and it's helpful to give up trying to control our experience, particularly in meditation. Happiness lies in not trying so hard. Sometimes it's a lot easier to strive and cling than it is to let go. Letting go is not so easy, is it? In fact, we need to make a certain amount of effort just to carve out time to sit, to show up to Sangha. To find time to sit at home takes some effort. To get on the cushion and to stay there takes some effort, right? It does feel like efforting sometimes. But practice starts with intention. So I like to emphasize this aspect of intention rather than effort. Intention, by the way, is another path factor on the Eightfold Path. So our intention is to practice. And to the best of our ability, it's helpful to let go of trying to get something and trust that that which we need to get will arrive quite naturally out of the practice itself. It'll take some trust. Sometimes this feels like a contradiction. So effort and practice is a balance. We have to carve out some time to sit, to meditate, find a place, make the intention to do so, get in a posture where we're awake and alert, and then relax. And simply be receptive to our direct experience. This is why meditation is really a skill-building practice, something we learn how to do, like learning a language or how to play a musical instrument. The more we do it, the better we get. Every moment of mindfulness conditions further moments of mindfulness. Mindfulness, like everything else, is a conditioned thing. The more we do it, the better we get at it. And it gets easier. Not to say it's always easy, even for people with a considerable amount of experience. We all go through times of ease and difficulty. But in general, it gets easier. So what are we hoping to get out of all this not efforting? Freedom from suffering? Enlightenment? Surely these things require some cultivation. Not necessarily. Wisdom and compassion arise out of simply doing the practice. From paying attention to our direct experience and being receptive to any insights that arise from that practice. I was reminded at this retreat I was at by a prominent Buddhist scholar that in the early Buddhist suttas, the Buddha's earliest teachings, he did not teach the cultivation of the Brahma-viharas, of metta, of love, of compassion, of joy and equanimity. He didn't teach the cultivation of these things. But he taught rather that they pointed out that they arise naturally from simply doing the practice, being in the moment, paying attention to your present experience in the here and now, and receiving the insights that arise from that practice. It was only several hundred years after the Buddha died that other writers and practitioners developed cultivation practices for the Brahma-viharas. And I'm a big fan of them. I recommend them. I love metta practice, particularly. But it was a great solace to me to be reminded that in the Buddha's own time, the Buddha said that these things are naturally part of us already. Joy, compassion, love, equanimity are already with us. They simply need to be uncovered. They will arise quite naturally out of practice. So it's a good reminder. There's different ways of coming by love and joy. Cultivating them is one path. But simply being present with our direct experience and letting our big self, our ego, get out of the way, quite naturally opens up our experience to the already existing love and compassion. It's already there. Adyashanti, local teacher, says, when we meditate, when we let go of control and allow everything to be as it is, our natural tendency is to awaken. We are biologically and psychologically wired to move towards awakening. A lot of people don't know that. But when we let go of control that the ego has, the nature of our being is to awaken. So, even awakening is a matter of letting go. There's short moments of awakening that you may very well have experienced tonight. Moments in your meditation that were absent of greed, aversion, delusion. Simply a moment of emptiness or quiet or tranquility. And then there's the big awakening, enlightenment. And there's a whole range of experience between those two poles. So awakening is not so very far away. You're already awake. We simply need to get out of the way. There's all kinds of practices, but I recommend the fairly simple instructions that we offer at Mission Dharma and in this tradition. monks do some pretty amazing things with their practices. This story doesn't particularly relate to this talk, but I just really wanted to share it because it's cool. I heard it from one of these teachers on the retreat I was just at, that there's Tibetan monks that meditate so much and are so proficient at meditation that they've taught themselves to meditate in their sleep. And it can be confusing because they actually don't know sometimes whether they're awake or asleep. When you develop those kinds of powers of mind, it's you lose boundaries sometimes. So there's a test they do. I'd never heard of this before. That whether they think they're asleep or they think they're dreaming, and they're being mindful in either case, the test you do to know whether you're awake or asleep or dreaming is you open up a book and you randomly turn to some page, notice the page number, read the first paragraph, and then close it. Then open up the book again, find that page, and if the first paragraph is the same paragraph you read before, you're awake. And if it's a different one, you're dreaming. So the other story that we often hear about monks, and I've tried this in my own experience and I've not gotten close, is that it's possible to know whether you fall asleep on an in-breath or an out-breath. If you're truly being mindful of your body and your experience. So that's one you might try. I find being mindful, applying mindfulness, practicing my mindfulness, when I'm going to sleep and I'm waking up, it's a really interesting experience. I really can't tell when exactly the moment is that I wake up. My mind is already going. But in any case, that's not directly applicable to right effort. That's maybe a little bit more effort than you want to apply. I tend to like simplicity, and it's one of the things that really appeals to me about this practice, and particularly this tradition of Buddhism, is that it incorporates a lot of joy and a lot of simplicity. And the instructions can be very profound in their simplicity. I just want to repeat Ajahn Amaro's instruction. It's one of my favorites. Let the body assume its natural ease. It's assuming that our body's natural state is at ease. And likewise, let the mind assume its natural ease. Now, just stay alert to anything that arises to disturb that natural ease. So the emphasis in that instruction is to notice ease and peace wherever we can find it in our experience when we're sitting. And also to notice disturbances as they arise. And if we can manage to not be disturbed by the disturbances, just let them be. Oh, there's a disturbance. There's a thought. There's a bodily sensation. And return to our natural ease. The practice can be quite simple and easy. So I encourage you to have an easier time of it than I did in my beginning years of meditation. Simply listen to the instructions and try to get out of the way. This big ego that we have is not always our best friend, especially in meditation practice. But don't listen to me. I invite you, as the Buddha did, to check this out in your own experience. The Buddha said, don't listen to me. Check it out in your own experience. See if this works for you. Develop a mind that is vast like water, where experiences both pleasant and unpleasant can appear and disappear without conflict, struggle, or harm. Rest in a mind that is like water. Wisdom of the Buddha. So, that's about all I have to say. I wanted to keep it fairly simple. We have a few minutes, and I'm wondering if anybody has a comment or a question or something in your own experience that got triggered but why I was talking about what I was talking about tonight. Please. I'm sorry about impermanence. Talk a little bit about impermanence. I'd be happy to. I'm talking about practice. So I'd like to talk about impermanence in practice. It's one of the most one of the ways that we get out of the way, I think, for me in my own practice is by noticing impermanence. You've probably noticed that we can't shut off, or it's not very effective to shut off thoughts or feelings or bodily sensations or restlessness or tiredness or sleepiness. But if we simply sit and pay attention to our direct experience, we'll notice those things. And if we do just a little bit of investigation, the main thing we'll notice is that every one of them, every one of these phenomena, sounds, thoughts, feelings, sensations, arise and pass away. It's the nature of all conditioned phenomena, both in the macro sense and the micro sense. But in our meditation experience, it's basically an experience of impermanence. And if we see nothing else in our meditation, that experience of changing phenomena is an insight in itself. This is the nature of all things, to change. And for me, that insight is really helpful in, continues to be very helpful in putting aside my small sense of self, my ego self, because that's impermanent too. It comes and goes. Ideas about myself, feelings, moods. So when I say put aside your ego or your strong sense of self, I'm not telling you to squash it or try to make it go away. Just notice it as another impermanent thing, another aspect of your impermanent experience. We're just made up of this ever-changing body, ever-changing thoughts, ever-changing emotions. So impermanence is a wonderful thing to dwell on in meditation experience. Is that helpful? Impermanence is one of the three characteristics of experience, of all experience. The others being dukkha, the sense of dissatisfaction. And the reason dukkha, dissatisfaction, is one of the elements of all experience is because of impermanence. We are dissatisfied because everything changes. The things that we like disappear. The things that we don't like stay a little bit too long, don't disappear fast enough. And we can't control it. So for me, that's the essential definition of dukkha is that we're trying to control something that can't be controlled. We're trying to control impermanence. And the third aspect, third characteristic of all experience is anatta, or not self, which some people view as a kind of philosophical concept, but for me it's just simply another side of the diamond, the gem of dukkha and impermanence is if everything's impermanent, and if we're constantly fighting to try to control something we can't control, then that's an artificial self that's doing that. Letting go lets us get out of the way. Any other questions or comments? No. It was lovely sitting with you tonight. Thank you very much for your practice, for supporting your Sangha, showing up for yourselves, showing up for your Sangha. And I hope to see you many more times here at Mission Dharma. Have a lovely evening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.